This is The Guardian.
Hello and welcome to The Guardian Football Weekly. Another brilliant Liverpool-Man City game. Given the Reds' second half dominance, City will probably be happier with the draw. They could have stolen it in injury time when Jeremy Doku's left foot strike hit the post. They could have lost it in injury time when Jeremy Doku's right foot strike hit Alexis McAllister in the sternum. So much to discuss in the title decider that didn't feature the team at the top of the league. That's Arsenal, who just about beat Brentford. Kai Havertz could have been sent off, but wasn't, and scored the decisive header. Aaron Ramsdale quite relieved after a big error in one of the two games he now gets a season. In the race for the top four, Spurs hammer Villa, while John McGinn has a real get-it-launched moment on Destiny Adogi. Cut-and-paste Manchester United are bad, but win against cut-and-paste Everton just can't score goals. There's the rebirth of Danny Ings, some more work for Mark Clattenburg at Forest, and the mesmerising delivery of Andros Townsend. All that plus Neil Warnock leaving Aberdeen, Neville Southall on tap water, your questions, and that's today's Guardian Football Weekly. On the panel today, Will Unwin, welcome.
Hello, Max.
Hello, Salon Andy Hickman.
Hello, Max.
And hello, Barry Glendenning.
Hi, Max. How are you doing?
I'm all right, thanks. Andy says, was that too much Barclays for one game? Liverpool won, City won. Barry, I thought it was compelling from start to finish. It was a brilliant game of football.
Yeah, it was really superb, and I'm glad it lived up to the oceans of hype in the week before the game. It was often chaotic, breathless, intense, end-to-end. Could have gone either way. Probably should have gone Liverpool's way on the back of their second half performance. Then it should have gone City's way with that Doku shot you mentioned, and should have gone Liverpool's way again, probably with that Doku high boot into the chest, which I'm sure of McAllister, which I'm sure we'll get to. So good performances all over the pitch, and I think Gary Neville is likened playing at Anfield to being chucked into a washing machine, and at times during the second half, City's players looked like, you know, a bit flustered and bamboozled in a way we don't often see from them. And I'd say they'd be very glad of the point, and Liverpool could end up looking at this as 2 points dropped, because their second half performance was superb, and they didn't really get the rewards they deserve from it. I think with a bit more composure from Luis Diaz, they'd have won that game comfortably.
Yeah, I thought he was brilliant, but missed those chances. Look, Will, you're a City fan. Salon, you're a Liverpool fan. As we established this week, it matters more to Liverpool fans. So I'll go to Salon first. What did you make of that performance, especially Liverpool in the second half?
Liverpool were incredible in that second half, but I think Barry hit the nail on the head. It was all over the pitch, was a completely exceptional performance, I think, from both teams. And I think before the game, I think lots of Liverpool fans were saying that we would really take a draw in that game, and that always feels different with hindsight once you've sat there and watched your team play some exceptional football in the second half, have so many good chances, have a few very clear-cut chances that Luis Diaz just didn't hit the target, and then have the Doku challenge in the last minute of the game. You can feel like you did drop 2 points, but I think once it's settled, and I think thinking about Man City and what they can do and what they can bring, I'm really happy with that point. And I think we did play brilliantly, and particularly with that bit of a four of that team not being sort of regular starters, it's just consistent brilliance. And there is a sadness about that being also like the last sort of Klopp-Pep in the league rivalry, and everyone's saying they'll be back, but I just, in this form, it's really hard to see where we'll get to having that level of excellence from both teams again, really, which is the sad bit for me.
Will, thoughts?
This podcast means more to me, that's the key thing.
it was interesting, because in the first 20 minutes, it looked like City were going to run away with it. The complete dominance, had a lot of possession in the final third, but without really creating a dangerous opportunity until opening the scoring. I must thank Rob Smythe for handing over the minute by minute to me on Saturday, because he was ill. So I had a furious 2 hours of typing in the madness, which was quite a jaunt for me. But yeah, I thought City actually, they were really good in the first half. There was a moment just in injury time in the first half, which I thought actually started tipping the balance when Rodri got booked for a pretty needless foul in the final few seconds. And when Rodri's booked, you're in a little bit of trouble because it puts him in a precarious position. And we came out in the second half with a sort of self-destruct button because something must have flicked a little bit when you make two colossal errors, poor back pass, and Edison loses his head. You've got to be a bit smarter with that Nunes challenge. You sort of, let him go by maybe and risk it.
Maybe he'd seen John McGinn earlier that afternoon and thought, I'll have some of that.
Wasn't it suspicious?
Why not?
But yeah, I'd say in the end, the second half was all Liverpool completely. And I mentioned in the minute-by-minute, City would take the point. Kovacic came on to bring the control that was completely lacking in City's midfield, and De Bruyne can complain as much as he wants, but actually probably more sensible to have Foden on the pitch at the moment, just because I think he's probably got more legs overall. And so, it was a good point for City. They can take a lot of positives that actually they did keep Liverpool out. It was a lot of hard work, and other teams probably wouldn't be able to maintain that level in defence to hold them back. I know they had a few chances, but Ortega made the one save from Nunes from the 6-yard line. But apart from that, there wasn't anything really significant they had to do, I would argue. So City can be pleased with that. And obviously what happened in the last minutes also. We say the last minute, it was like 10 minutes of added on time. I think City will be very happy with the point in the end. And it was a difficult game to get through, but getting through it probably does City quite a lot of good going forward. And they've got Arsenal next in the league. So, it's a fun position to be in. And then they've got Aston Villa, who are terrible now, it turns out. So, it's a fun little period after the international break for them.
Scott says, on the certain foul seen and given, not a foul scale, where does Barry place Doku's, given that Kyle Walker breathing in the vicinity of Marcus Rashford was definitely a foul just a week ago? I think I've only seen Shay given on Match of the Day, and producer Joel suggest that shouldn't be a penalty. I don't know what you think, Baz.
Would not have been in the least bit surprised if it had been given. I don't necessarily agree that with the theory that if it happens anywhere else on the pitch, it is not. It is obviously a foul and a yellow card. But when it wasn't given, I wasn't surprised that it wasn't overturned. So I think it is probably a foul. I don't think it was as brutal an assault as some are making out. I think Doku actually, there was no force in it. He tried to pull his foot back. And But yeah, I wouldn't have been in the least bit surprised if it had been given. And my first impression was, oh yeah, that's a penalty.
Yeah.
But it looks worse slowed down than it.
It wasn't Nigel de Jong, was it?
No. So I'm going to sit in the fence with this one. I wouldn't have been surprised if it was given, and I can totally understand why Jurgen Klopp and various other Liverpool people associated with Liverpool, be they players, fans, whatever, are aggrieved.
Solon, I presume you think it was a penalty, but I don't want to sort of spend hours on that. I'd rather talk about Luis Diaz, because I thought he was brilliant, but also cost you the game is not fair, is it? But he had those chances where he just couldn't get the ball under control, or he missed that one-on-one. But I thought he was so brilliant, and I thought he led the chaos in a sort of Darwin Nunes-y way yesterday.
He did, and just on the penalty, I think it probably was a penalty, but it also doesn't have, for me, quite the sort of latency or like I don't feel as strongly or as powerfully that I don't feel aggrieved necessarily. And I think that's always a marker of, okay, well, it could have gone either way. So I think probably a lot of Liverpool fans will feel that way. And Klopp in his post-match kind of named it, didn't he? He was like, I'm angry, but also how can you be angry when we just played like that? So, but on Diaz, you have to have a player like him coming up against Pep's desire for control, because you need someone to just come in there and sort of really cause the chaos that will allow Liverpool to unlock Liverpool to start playing. And he did that fantastically. And for him, I don't think he's ever started that fixture before either. So for him, that was a massive thing. You've got the intensity of the Anfield crowd, and usually, we put him through on goal, and you would expect him to finish. And I think I don't know. A couple of his first touches didn't set himself to really get his body position in the right way to then be able to create the opportunity. And I think, yeah, I'd be averse to saying he cost us the game because, you know, he worked so hard and got us into some brilliant positions. He just couldn't finish in some really clinical places yesterday. And it did let us down, but I don't think it's the reason we lost the game. Well, not lost the game, drew the game.
Yeah. You know, there was that run where he sort of beat everybody and then we sort of ended, I think he won a corner, he was just flat on his back. He's absolutely just destroyed. But you know, it was an amazing bit of play. You mentioned Ceylon, actually, you know, the back four, and we'll get to Van Dijk in a second, but I thought, you know, Conor Bradley's been amazing, right? It's just amazing how good he is. Like sort of sitting there going, maybe he's better than Trent Alexander-Arnold at right back. I'm not sure now. And Jarrell Quansah, who is definitely better than Harry Maguire. It's all I was watching this game going, could we get him? Can he could play, couldn't he? We could just get him. I thought he was so composed.
He was. And I think it's just a testament to what is being instilled in these younger players that they can go out there and play with that confidence and bravery. Quansah, I think, was in the second half quite late on where he just drove through and just took that shot as well from about 30 yards out. And I think that sort of confidence, level of quality, synergy as well to be able to slot in and take a game like that on an occasion and just go, yeah, this is my position and these are the players that I play alongside, is a real marker of kind of the culture of what is being built for those younger players to come in and play there, and a testament to their own individual sort of how hard they're working, how much they're learning, how much they're willing to learn. And I think, yeah, it's a brilliant, brilliant squad to be inheriting for whoever comes next.
Well, what did you make of Haaland versus Van Dijk? There was that moment where suddenly Haaland was through and it was just Van Dijk, and it was a bit like the final scene in a movie where the two are finally, it's just on their own together, normally on top of a train, and they're just there. And actually Haaland got a shot away, and like he could have, if he'd put it in the corner, we'd have all said that was pretty terrible defending, but it looked like Van Dijk did enough. But generally, Van Dijk won that battle.
Desperation to drag out Sky's metaphors about Liverpool v City being similar to the Oscars, you know, expecting.
Sorry, I didn't see any of that. So like, this is my own doing.
Absolutely unbearable.
I can imagine.
But expecting to sort of fall in each other's arms, realising they're sort of the adversaries have always needed, but actually they love each other more than anyone could ever know. Yeah, it was. Haaland really wasn't in it. And he's generally not in games, let's be honest. That's not his role. He produces finishes from nothing, really, a lot of the time. He finds that little bit of movement. He's not there to link up play generally. You know, I'm sure his touch count was about -4 or something, which is a shame. But yeah, that was obviously the big moment. And Van Dijk is an incredibly experienced defender and just pushed Haaland wider than you'd want to be. So you're a little bit off balance. You can't get the right amount of power and accuracy in the shot that you want. And it was quite a simple save for Keller. And yeah, Van Dijk was incredible, considering four of that back five were not the first choice, from goalkeeper to right back, Quansah, Gomez at left back. So they did really well to manage Haaland. And say, repeating myself, but that first 20 minutes you thought, oh, this defence can be got at. But they recovered very well and they were marshalled very well to stop City. You know, in for early doors, they were getting a bit of space down City's left. Alvarez had some space against Bradley, and Silva was picking up, you know, pockets of space that he was utilising well. But those sort of things went quite quickly. So, you know, Liverpool adapted to what City were doing. And, and that's what limited Haaland's enjoyment in the final third, because the ball never really got to him. You know, there was one moment where it looked like he was going to head it in at the back post, and Liverpool just got there in time to flick it over for a corner. So, yeah, it was a pretty quiet one for Erling. Just make him angrier, won't it? And just on the penalty, clearly McAllister dived. Like, how's no one pointed this out yet? I don't get it.
Well, it was quite funny when McAllister was lying on the floor, but the ball was still near him, and he was just sort of, now he was just sort of like a body that they had to sort of play around. I from City, Baz, I thought, I was just so impressed with John Stones, actually, who is sort of this remarkable, like, his development. I know he scored a goal, so it's sort of obvious to highlight him. But just the way he played in midfield, in a midfield where lots of people were playing well, was seriously impressive, I thought.
Yeah, he's been really impressive in recent games. He's in the form of his life and has hugely improved as a player under Pep Guardiola. The goal, I think, was brilliant. I mean, the corner routine... for Kevin De Bruyne to send in that delivery without putting the ball out of play, because it was an outswinger, wasn't it? The Ake blocked off someone at the near post, McAllister, I think it was, and Stones crept into the gap and put the ball away at the near post. But just an incredibly assured performance among... I mean, it's easier just to pick out who didn't perform, really, because everyone was... I thought Haaland had a conspicuously ineffective and anonymous game, although it was him who played that ball wide to Doku to set up the chance where he hit the post. That was a good pass, but he didn't really contribute much else. But yeah, Stones is having a great time at the moment.
Mm. Yeah, I thought Foden was pretty quiet actually in that game. I mean, that's just a testament to how Liverpool played, I guess, Ceylon. And now it's all done. Like, how do you feel about the title race now? I mean, clearly it's obviously completely impossible to call because 2 points separate three sides.
I don't see it as a major setback within the title race. I still think those two have got to play each other next. And Arsenal are just so in form at the moment that I do think it's the one time where Arsenal could get a really good result against City. For us, I think we just have to, you just literally have to win every single game now, and that's all you can do and that's all you can control. It's so funny. I'm actually also at Dulwich Hamlet in a three-horse title race at the moment, where we were playing yesterday and we won convincingly 4-1, but our rivals are Dartford and Fulham for the title. And when I went onto the pitch, Dartford were losing to Millwall 2-1. And when we came off and the final whistle went, I was like, yes, we've won 4-1. What was the Dartford score? And they came back to win 3-2. And then I just felt like we'd just lost. We'd just lost the game. It was just so, it's so frustrating when they have to lose for us to win the league. And I think that's the same thing as like, all you can do is concentrate every single week on what you can do and your performances and win every game. And yes, every game is a cup final, and Arsenal creating that feeling at the Emirates massively where you're going into that space. Liverpool are doing it at Anfield. Doubts whether City will ever manage to do it at the Etihad. But out of the three, I'd say it's Liverpool or Arsenal's now at this point. I don't know if City have the energy to keep doing it as they have done, there feels like a lot more massive forces around Liverpool and Arsenal to really go for this.
So would you want City to beat Arsenal or Arsenal to beat City? Or would you want a draw?
I would like a draw, please. I will be the... Do you see the memes of Arteta sitting in the VAR booth on the Doku challenge? That will be me against those two, wanting a draw.
Will, where did... I mean, again, it doesn't change much, does it?
No, it changes pretty much nothing, especially with, obviously, the run of fixtures ahead for each team. Yeah, interesting that City v Arsenal now will just be a battle of set pieces, sort of, who... Big Sam style. It's just Allardyce versus Dyche now with clever set pieces to come. I would disagree. I think City have got a lot of energy to give. They've done it in the past. They've got a lot of experience in dealing with the Champions League and the Premier League. And I don't think there's any shortage of energy, I'd say, at City. I think they're still look pretty ruthless at times. I won't worry about that. I think it's going to go to be free horse race right to the end.
Let's move on to Arsenal's win over Brentford then. Their eighth win in a row in the league. And I guess, Baz, a bit like Liverpool's win at Forest last week, you're going to have to grind some out and get a bit lucky. And on the balance of the game, they probably deserved it. But on the big moments, they had the fortune, didn't they, Arsenal?
Yeah, they've won 10 points now this season in the last 5 minutes of games. And that's a testament, that's a good thing. It's that they're not lucky, they just keep going. And Arsenal of yore may not have won any of those 10 points, or only about half of them. This wasn't one of the more impressive performances. They were still worthy winners against a team that were missing their entire first choice back four. Aaron Ramsdale, his mistake has been highlighted, obviously, because of the whole Ramsdale-Reyes soap opera, or slightly confected soap opera. Mikel Arteta has always made it clear who his first choice keeper is. This is, one of those ones you have to grind out. Brentford probably offered more than I thought they would, and they certainly offered more than many of Arsenal's recent opponents. So they did well to win this game.
Mm. Kai Havertz, 4 goals, 2 assists in his last 4 games. He is finding his place still on, isn't he? Whether he should have been on the pitch to score that header, I guess, is a pertinent question. But he is still, you know, he was always good, but now he seems to be in the right place doing the right things.
Yeah, and I think he's one of these players that has always had that, but there's always just been such a narrative around him that it's sometimes quite hard to break through that narrative where everyone kind of just thinks you're going to be a bit of a flop, and then everything you do sort of confirms that. And when you deny that narrative, it's always such a surprise to people that you've done that. And the thing for him, he has to be consistent now, and he has shown that in the last few games. I do think it was a dive, and he should not have been on the pitch to then score that header. But there's been so many talking points this weekend from refereeing. But yeah, it was a shame that one wasn't picked up, I think.
Yeah. I mean, the interesting thing, Will, isn't it? And I don't know if you agree or disagree, is we don't want VAR to get involved in everything. But then it's so counterintuitive that it can take 10 minutes to work out whether West Ham shouldn't have a penalty against Freiburg in the Europa League, and it can't take 5 seconds. It's not allowed to get involved to go, mate, that was a dive. It's not allowed to do that. Whereas actually, surely if a player is, maybe, I don't know, if a player is on a yellow card, suddenly VAR can get involved in yellow card decisions because they actually matter more.
Oh, fear for how much the game would be further slowed down based on this. I mean, it's a tricky one.
Maybe.
Especially, I think a lot of these dives, I would say it's a bit subjective, where you're trying to buy the contact and not being successful in Havertz's case. And, you know, some will buy it and there'll be a bit of contact, but it's probably not a penalty. But is that a dive? I mean, I think it would be a bit arduous to make VAR pick up more stuff, because frankly, this podcast would never end every week just discussing it. We'd just have a separate VAR podcast on a Tuesday. Get some former referee to help discuss it with us. You know, Mike Messias.
On the panel today, Mark Halsey.
Exactly.
Yeah, Keith Hackett. Yeah,
get them all in. So, yeah, I mean, if we go in for these sort of things, it would be tough. I mean, I think it was 50-50 whether it was an out-and-out dive or not. I did a minute-by-minute of this. I've had a busy weekend. I did call it a dive
really?
Straight away. So, yeah, I should probably stick to my guns, to be fair.
I actually did. Yeah. It was the Girls United International Women's Day tournament on Saturday, and they had a VAR experience. So you had a big screen, and it showed you an incident in real time, and then it divided the screen up into the 4 different camera angles. And you had to choose whether it was a penalty or not, and then you had to do a different one, was a red or yellow. And it... genuinely, I've developed empathy for VAR refs now, because it's so, the 4 different, 5 different angles that you get to watch, and the speed, and then you can slow it down. One of them will tell you that it's 100% a penalty. The other one will tell you that it's not 100% a penalty. So I've developed a bit more empathy on the VAR conversation, but I would not want that as a job.
I do think if we run with this idea of having a Tuesday VAR special and had a 2 or 3 refs on each time, they'd never agree with each other, and that sort of is the nub of the problem, isn't it? They seem to be a very chippy bunch who don't like each other very much. They're always, you know, ex-referees always calling out former colleagues and whatnot. So, yeah, that's a pot. It'd
be quite adversarial broadcasting, wouldn't it? When we discover. I mean, obviously, we know that Keith Hackett doesn't like me, so that's already some fire in this new podcast, isn't it? It's worth mentioning Ivan Toney's brilliant effort. Oof. And Ramsdale did very well to save that. I mean, there were 2 efforts from long range this weekend, Eberechi-Eze and that one, and they were both so good, and it's a shame that neither of them went in, but like, well done to Ramsdale, because he probably wasn't expecting it, and it was a good save. So there we are. That is the top of the table. Arsenal 64 points from 28 games, same as Liverpool. Man City a point behind. Part 2, we'll begin with the race for the top 4. Welcome to part 2 of the Guardian Football Weekly. So the top 4 battle then. Villa played 28, 55 points. Spurs 27, 53 points. Manchester United, who we're still including in this, 47 points from 28 games. That's because Spurs won 4-0 at Villa Park in a brilliant second half. Shturk says, can we all agree that Ange Ball, when it works, is the most watchable football in the league? Barry, agree or disagree?
Yeah, I suppose it is very watchable, definitely. I think Villa slightly played into Tottenham's hands yesterday. First half wasn't much to talk about. I think Villa had the best chance at a John McGinn delivery that Luca Dean headed over not long before half-time. But Villa, their approach in this game seemed quite meek, uncharacteristically meek. They played five at the back, which is not their usual formation. And Spurs just left themselves, I think, deliberately short of numbers at the back, and they pressed and pressed and pressed, pinned Villa back into their own half and reduced them to playing long balls up towards Ollie Watkins. It was really good by Spurs, and their tactics paid dividend early in the second half, and then John McGinn lost his head and that was it, game over. I mean, Villa, they were 2-0 down, but there was still loads of time to go, and I mean, the cross from Papisar for the Maddison goal, that was beautiful. What a cross. But at 2-0 down, Villa were still in the game, could have rescued a point, and yeah, John McGinn just lost the plot.
Yeah. Brendan says, any word from NASA on when Destiny Adogi is expected to come out of orbit? Dave says, in hindsight, was it a poor decision for John McGinn to try to volley Adogi's shin into Rose Ed? It was strange, Will. And I suppose it felt to me like it's one of those, it's like an Instagram football fights page, that sort of challenge. Like, you see that, you just sort of, people are always sending me these, you know, look at this in Sunday League, and just someone just hoys into someone for absolutely no reason. It didn't feel like that sort of game. It didn't feel like Spurs were dominating Villa to such a degree that John McGinn would just go, oh, I just can't do this anymore.
Yeah, I was slightly upset that Ndoggy decided to try and walk away immediately instead of jump up in the air and then go down. Yeah, it's a very strange challenge, and there was no attempt to get the ball. Pure force, you know. You'd expect sort of 20 substitutes on in to run on and try and separate players and stuff like that. It could get quite, you know, physical on the touchline. It was very, you know, it's very strange to see these things in the Premier League in general. You expect some more of the discussions of cute tactical fouls now. The pure physicality ones where you're never going to get away with it is quite odd. And you know, John McGinn's not that type of player, obviously, we have to say that. But yeah, it was a pretty horrible foul, just pure force, like no real knowledge of where the ball was at the time, really. Just, he was very late, very frustrated from something or other, I guess. And, you know, he's going to take his punishment of a three-match ban, and forever this will be brought up the next time he makes a tackle, because then he will be that sort of player for every single game for the rest of his career. When it's a bit 50-50, they think, oh, he has got a bit of malice in him, hasn't he? Old John. He's a dirty player now. But yeah, it's completely ruined the game for Villa, and you know, they're looking very tired and struggling possibly with the dealings of Thursday night, Sunday football, where Spurs, yeah, they look very, very much happy to deal with the extra space and have the extra energy. I've never seen a team have such an overload in the final third constantly. Sort of, however many players are back for the opposition, Spurs seem to have more. It's quite impressive. A very noble version of football from Ange. So yeah, for Spurs, look like they might take the momentum, and yeah, they're getting the players back and not suffering suspensions for silly tackles.
We're told the Doku high boot on McAllister wasn't given because VAR decided it was an unavoidable coming together. I would say McGinn and Adogi was quite avoidable as coming together as go.
One issue for Spurs is Van der Ven's injury, because he is so, he's been just one of the players of the season, I think. I think he's such a, I mean, he's just so fast, but composed as well. What Salon, have you made of Ange? Because like, a lot's been made that he is a boyhood Liverpool fan. Perhaps it's come a bit early, but you know, you're still surveying, I presume, just checking you know, how near Xabi Alonso is to Munich at any given moment. But what have you made of Postecoglou's impact on the Premier League?
I'm actually not in camp Alonso. It's too early for Alonso. I want Thomas Frank for a couple of years and then we get Alonso in. That's my big call on it. What do I make of Ange? I love any manager in men's football who is able to sort of harness the social and emotional side of the game and marry it with tactical brilliance. And when I think Ange has that in him, and I think he has that potential. I don't think he has it as consistently as Klopp, and I think also a lot of Klopp's tactical stuff, I think, is also about the team around him. And I think, I don't know much about who's around Ange, right? Who are the people that, you know, he goes to are absolute specialists on all different parts of the pitch. But as a figurehead and someone who can galvanize and understands the kind of, yeah, the emotional side of the game and the sort of arm around the shoulder style management, I love it. And I think he's a brilliant addition to the Prem. I think Spurs, with Van de Ven going out, it really does impact how Ange likes to play, right? He's so important for them to play, being able to play a high line and to do that press that I think broke down Villa. So we'll see how they get on without him, because it wasn't great when they lost him earlier in the season and that felt like a bit of a tipping point for them. So yeah, we will see. I think I want Spurs under Ange to do well, because I really do like the guy.
Don't you think it's strange, Shalon, that more managers aren't able to harness what is really, I mean, maybe I'm oversimplifying it, just saying, you know, we love football because we love it, and, you know, fans matter and the players matter and we all matter. And it's, you know, Klopp has it in abundance. I'm not sure Pep does. So you don't necessarily need to have it, but it does seem like an obvious thing to a card to play, because it means everybody likes you.
100%. I think this is where the marginal gains are now. I think you can have some of the best tactical minds in football getting players to execute a plan, but where I think the things are to be gained, and I think you see it in Klopp, you see it in Ange, you see it in Southgate, you see it in Serena Wiegmann, is the one-to-one relational and the group, like, relational dynamic stuff, which is something I'm fascinated by. But I also think if you can get a club with its everything around that club, whether it's players, fans, staff, everything, the city, if you can get that firing in sort of this beautiful concoction of, we're all working towards the same thing and everyone here matters and is valued, and as the manager you can make everyone feel that, I think you just get these yards ahead of people that, you know, you can, as well as you're having to match it with how you play football and the innovations that you bring into the game. But I do think that is where, you know, the Sean Dyches of this world, or, you know, they don't have that. Yeah, and they don't take in that into account, and then they just kind of have one less tool in the toolbox.
Mm. Speaking of marginal gains and of Sean Dyche as well, let's go to Old Trafford for Manchester United 2, Everton 0. Everton became the fifth side in 6 Premier League games to have at least 20 shots against Manchester United. Which says, I guess, Barry, that Manchester United still aren't very good and Everton cannot score goals, which are things that we knew already before this game.
Yeah, Manchester United didn't need to be at, or weren't at, anywhere near their best in this game, and they didn't need to be. They won it quite comfortably because Everton gifted them 2 penalties with just dumb challenges, really dumb challenges, on Alejandro Garnacho by Tarkowski and Ben Godfrey. Everton had chances to score, but Everton being Everton, they didn't take them because they're just incapable of scoring at the moment. Their 2 strikers are both misfiring. Dominic Calvert-Lewin hasn't scored in 21 or 22 games, I think. Beto isn't any more, well, he's slightly more prolific. I think he's got 2 Premier League goals this season, maybe 3. And Dwight McNeil missed a couple. Doucouré missed one. Lewis Dobbin missed a fairly presentable chance. So United were quite bad in patches of this game. Casemiro could not hang on to the ball. I think he gave it away 17 times. And United were very charitable in terms of letting Everton have the ball, courtesy of sloppy passes and whatnot. They had 23 chances and no goals. So a comfortable win for Man U, and any other team you would imagine would have giving them far more problems.
Are you saying Dobbin is a bit of a donkey, Barry, or
isn't Dobbin traditionally a horse rather than a donkey?
Well, a mule, but you know, like
I'm off to Cheltenham really a footballing this week, insult. And it is critical I know the difference between a horse and a donkey. I suspect if I have any bets, I'll be putting my money on donkeys. But yeah,
I just wanted to try it and see how it went with my Dobbin the mule. Wasn't that a kids' show in like the 60s? I don't know. Anyway, Will, to the present, I know English is not Ten Hag's first language. And so you've always got to be careful when, you know, criticising somebody who you know, who is in that position. But like after every game now, Ten Hag says, we were great. And then Bruno Fernandes comes out and goes, I'm not sure we were that great today. And like eventually you're waiting for Ten Hag to go, look, we could be a bit better. I just really sense that he is gone this summer.
It's interesting talking about personality of managers and stuff, and Ten Hag has not particularly shown, you know, a particularly interesting character, I'd say. And I'd suspect Sir Jim, knowing roughly what he likes in his staff, he wants a bit more from his managers, a bit more zing, a bit of, you know, etc. And it is tricky for Ten Hag, not his first language, but as someone sits in his press conferences a lot and speaks to him, it can be quite arduous at times. And he's, you know, he's quite honest generally about other things, but yeah, United's performances is never one that he can be too open about. He's too desperate to say they're making progress when honestly I don't think they are. You know, you look at Saturday and they won it in the two boxes thanks to the academy with Alejandro Garnacho and plucky young youngster graduated from the academy in about 2010. Johnny Evans. So, you know, it's really not exactly, you know, enthusiastic football to watch at times. They were all right in the final third. They were pretty awful in midfield, and they just about got away with it at the back. And they've won two. They scored from two penalties, and I don't think Pickford had to do much else. He saved a free kick.
Made a decent save from a Fernandes free kick. Yeah, Dobbin the horse and Muffin the mule, I'm reliably told. So it didn't work on any level, my Dobbin the donkey joke. Look, that result means Everton are 16th. Bottom of the table looks like this. Sheffield United 14 from 28. Burnley 14 from 28. Luton 21 from 27. Forest 24 from 28. Everton 25 from 28. Obviously, Forest and Everton may still be docked more points. Brentford 26 from 28 and Palace 29 from 28. Palace and Luton drew one apiece. That injury time last kick brackets head of the game from Corley Woodrow. Still on, how did Luton get anything from this game? I feel like Palace should have been 20-0 up by the time Luton scored.
Palace can't hold on to a win, and Luton can smell blood in the last 5 minutes of a game and get a result. And that is just the perfect coming together for me as someone who wants Luton to do well and not get relegated. Although I'm very torn because I've been watching a lot of Palace recently and going home and away with them, and it is so, so much fun. But I just think, you know, I grew up in Luton, playing for Luton Town as a child. So for me, they have to stay up. But they're so cliche, isn't it? But the whole never say die, when they know, they do not give up till that last minute. But it's almost like the game plan now. It's like, right, when you have that confidence and you've done it multiple times, it's like, we will get something from this game in the last few minutes. Palace, there was the stat around, if they've conceded 18 goals from the 80th minute onwards, which I think a lot of that's down to kind of training session. Well, what I hear is training sessions not being particularly intense enough under Hodgson. But there's also this stat, which also has the 18, in which they've given up 18 points from a winning position, and they would be fourth if they hadn't have given up those points. Which, when this was a topic of conversation on our team bus yesterday, someone did say, well, that's like if my nan had wheels, she'd be a bicycle. You can't say that. It doesn't make sense. But I think, you know, Palace just cannot hold on, and they need to look into that and work out those last 30 seconds of a game. Just get the ball out. Just get it out.
Yeah. How come you're going to see Palace home and away?
Well, my friend works at the club, and right. I've just started going with her, and it is so much fun. Honestly, some of the best fans in the Premier League, I think. They are beautiful people to spend time with. And a lot of the songs are the same as Dulwich songs. So
right, it's easy. I mean, of all the sides, Barry, Crystal Palace should know that Andros Townsend might onto his left foot and stick the ball in the box.
Yeah, it was a great cross. I don't think it was... Well, it wasn't as good as Papissarra's. I've got to say it probably was, but yeah.
Different skills, I guess.
The way he was allowed to chop inside and send in the cross was... It's just criminal, you know. They are familiar with Andros's work at Selhurst Park. But hats off to Luton for hanging in there in the face of, you know, what should have been a slaughter, really. Palace missed so many chances. Harking back to what Solan was saying there, wasn't there some time years ago where someone arrived at the conclusion that if games only lasted 80 minutes, I think it was Fulham maybe, would have been, under Laurie Sanchez, would have been, you know, runaway leaders of the Premier League. And Laurie Sanchez kept promoting this theory, and someone sort of took him to what's it. But the thing is, Laurie, games are actually 90 minutes. So, you know, that's perhaps more what you should be focusing on. Good point. Great point for Luton. And they...
Yeah, Colin Woodrow's second ever Premier League goal. The first was a decade ago, also against Crystal Palace. So, you know, Solon, if you are still going home and away in 2034, look out for his next goal when he's 39 years old. Brighton beat Nottingham Forest 1-0. I mean, Brighton were smashed by Roma, Will, on Thursday night. And I'm really in a not in a good moment, I think is the phrase. And you could see, like, at the end of this game, they celebrated like they had, you know, the Goldstone ground had just been saved. Like, it really was sort of epic celebrations from Roberto De Zerbi and friends.
Yeah, I think De Zerbi looks, he's been quite frustrated in recent weeks. You know, he made some comments about transfers and whatnot after January. The team has struggled to perform. It was a very un-De Zerbi-like performance yesterday, really sort of grinding it out against, let's be honest, not a top-notch Forest team, you know, needing an own goal to get it. And Forest had a very good chance to equalise. Brighton slightly lucky to keep 11 players on the pitch. But yeah, so it's a big result, especially after such a thrashing Europe, and that's ended their European campaign. They're not coming back from that this week, let's be honest. So yeah, they need to sort of regroup, and the best way to do that is by picking up wins, and you know, we've done that by hook or by crook at the weekend. And apart from Forrest hilarious moaning that the own goal shouldn't count because their goalkeeper missed the ball because, I don't know, a ghost had pushed him, I don't know. But, yeah.
I mean, they should be used to Nottingham Forest keepers. That's like the third Nottingham Forest keeper who just misses the ball as a sort of matter of habit.
Recruitment in the goalkeeping department at Forest has underwhelmed this season. If only
their manager used to have been a goalkeeper.
Yeah, well, he really likes Sells. He really pushed for Sells. But, yeah, Turner... and the other goalkeeper signed in the summer were really strange decisions for him. I think the goalkeeping coach, he's got a few questions.
Have we all forgotten who the other keeper was?
But he's got a very long name and I can't remember how to pronounce it.
Oh, yes.
It's the Greek lad.
No, it's the one that people think sounds like Shakadimus and Pliers.
Yeah, Vlachodimos.
Vlachodimos.
Yeah. That's it, Vlachodimos.
I exactly remember who he is. Yeah. Give Wayne Hennessy a go. I can remember his name. He's the fourth choice. Mm. So where were we? Forest can't sign goalkeepers. Bad.
And look, Nuno was upset. They didn't wheel out Mark Clattenburg. So Nuno had to say, Moda went through Nico Williams, I think, didn't he? And I think that should have been a red, Baz, shouldn't it? I mean, Nuno says it's a red card. It's a red card. It's week after week. What's going on? Someone wants to put us down. Someone tell me it's not a red card. Someone tell me I'm being stupid. Maybe Mark Clattenburg was just out of shot and he was talking to Mark Clattenburg. I'm just being honest. But I think he had a point, didn't he?
Yeah, it should have been a red card, absolutely. Yes, it should have been a red card.
Thank you so much. And that'll do for part two. Part three, we'll do the rest of the Premier League. Welcome to part three of the Guardian Football Weekly. Sheffield United... we're winning 2-0, Ceylon, at Bournemouth. But there's only one place you can start with this game, and that is Dominic Solanke's penalty. How brilliant was that?
Oh, I felt for him so much. That is, it's always you can tell as well when you see a player's reaction afterwards, and they sort of like blame the ground, the air, the fans, everything around them that's kind of like not their fault that he didn't plant his foot correctly and then slipped. But he also just had a bit of a calamitous like game, and he had the slip. Then for the second goal, I think the keeper punches it onto Solanke's head, which then goes in or results in a goal. And then he gets a goal, but then it's ruled off for handball. It really wasn't his day. I think bad things come in threes, and, yeah. And Solanke really felt that.
It was very much a throwback to Dominic Solanke of old, when nothing ever seemed to go right for him. And this is his, you know, this is the best season of his career. Things like that aren't supposed to happen to the current iteration of Dominic Solanke.
I suppose the point is, if you can get them all out of the way in one game, you can have 37 really good games. And he has been really good. Sheffield United were good in this game, I thought, Baz. Chris Wilder said on Match of the Day afterwards, there's a narrative, isn't there? There's a narrative of Sheffield United being the worst team in the world. Burnley, we're all waiting for them to kick in and everything happens with them. And Luton are going for Europe. That seems to be the narrative. I mean, Sheffield United are also not very good, I would say, Barry. I mean, that is also like, I don't think that's a narrative.
I think that's quite a weird thing for a manager who's just seen his team get thumped 5-0, 6-0 repeatedly to come out and say, just because they've got a draw away at Bournemouth. Sheffield United are a really bad team. They're almost certainly going to go down. They deserve to go down. I'm not sure what exactly he's driving at there. It's not the first weird post-match comment he's come out with, obviously, in recent times, but
you can't say he's a couple of sandwiches short of a picnic. That's not fair to Chris Marler, is it?
Yeah, I really don't know what, you know, Sheffield United are where they are because they aren't very good and they deserve to be where they are. It's not like they've had a run of horrendous bad luck or terrible decisions go against them that have cost them points. They get well beaten with monotonous regularity, so it's no surprise they're at the bottom of the table. And if right, they showed signs of life here, but those signs of life are long overdue because they haven't improved since he's taken over. I would say they've got markedly worse.
But the other Chris Wilder comment was that it looked like a war zone out there. So many of my players went down with cramp. I don't want to make light of war, but I don't think cramp's the issue there, Christopher.
I mean... Cramp is bad. I got it. You get it in both legs.
God, oh, save it, Private Ryan. Oh, God, the cramp was terrible, wasn't it? Oh, no wonder it took so long to jog and find him. But yeah, Wilder's making a lot of excuses, but yeah, they're not very good and they're going down.
I remember when Dwayne Chambers ran the 100 metres in, like, I don't know, 10.8, and after he said, yeah, I got cramp in one leg, so I couldn't really push it. And you're like, God, imagine doing 100 metres with cramp and finishing it, let alone, you know, I don't know which iteration of Dwayne Chambers it was, but that would be quite hard.
How do you get cramp in the space of 10 seconds?
No idea. To the London Stadium, West Ham 2, Burnley 2. What impact Danny Ings had on this game, Sidon? He only came on in the 82nd minute and the whole game was about him.
He did. It was a brilliant finish for the equaliser. And obviously he had his he scored two goals in that very short space of time. Obviously one was ruled off for offside, but the one he actually got was a classic striker's finish, wasn't it? The way he took it down, swiveled and hit it. It's good to see that Danny Ings has still got it, you know? He can still do those things when you need him to. Maybe he can only do them for 10 minutes in a game, and maybe that's just his, you know, his future. But it's nice to see that he's still got it.
Yeah, but I mean, I guess no one knows because he's barely played under David Moyes. He's also hit the bar in injury time, didn't he? And I don't know. I mean, maybe that should change things. I think West Ham fans, Barry, are not happy at the moment. They lost to Freiburg in a game that was incredibly boring and sort of really epitomised what David Moyes would do in an away game in Europe. And if you're not beating Burnley at home, even though, like, he will come out afterwards, I'm sure, and say, I won us a trophy. Where are they? Probably seventh still. Like, all these things are true and are good for West Ham.
Yeah, he was able after this game to come out and say they should have had a penalty, which I think they should, Sanderberg. If that's not a handball, I don't know what is, but, well, nobody knows what a handball is anymore, but that seemed a particularly weird decision when he headed the ball into his own arms, which were in front of his face. And as far as I can tell, there's a certain section of West Ham fans who want Moyes out because they're sick of watching this unattractive football. And when you're ceding possession to Burnley and going, you have the ball, Burnley, despite being the second worst team in the league and despite being away from home, that's not going to change anyone's mind in the stand who already has their mind made up about Moyes. Their first half performance was terrible. They got a goal back very soon after the break due to a catalogue of defensive errors from Burnley. And then it was all West Ham from then on, really. They probably should have won the game, but didn't. And certainly nothing the West Ham fans who want Moyes out, and I think they're growing in numbers, nothing they saw there yesterday will change their minds. I don't think anyone's going to change their minds about him.
It's a culture war, isn't it? What side of the culture war? John Ronson will make a podcast about David Moyes. We'll all know where we stand on the culture war. Hats off to David Fofana, who's got an absolutely brilliant goal. Apparently he retweeted it at halftime. So presumably someone else is on his account, or maybe the Burnley players all get 1 minute to retweet their favourite thing from the first half. They just haven't had much opportunity to do it this season. At Molineux, Wolves beat Fulham 2-1. I mean, I thought, well, Fulham could have been out of sight before Wolves scored in this game, but Wolves are up to eighth, 1 point behind West Ham. They could get into Europe, and we should let Gary O'Neill do those slightly awkward fist pumps and applaud them.
Yeah, especially considering, you know, Cunha's out, Neto injured, probably needing to grow.
Quang's out as well.
Quang's out, yeah. It's, you know, there's not much left in the final third at Wolves. It's a good job that the left back and an own goal can see them through. You know, obviously, you know, Ike Nouri for the first one, then Semedo hit the one that went in off Kearney. But yeah, O'Neill's been, you know, transformative at Wolves, especially because of what the hands he's been dealt. Where you come in 4 days before the start of the season, you've had to sell all your best players. Nunes goes, Neves went as well. So this is, it's quite a tricky one to come into, and he's, you know, from the first game they've been incredible, really energised. You know, I was there the other week and against Sheffield United, and that was a pretty bad performance, but they still ground it out, and it's always good when you're not performing at your best to be able to grind it out. And when you haven't got much of a forward line, winning games is even better. And I think O'Neill said after the win that was, you know, the best one for various reasons under him, and there've been some pretty decent ones. So, you know, it shows that things are going well, and if their financial situation is helped by finishing, you know, in the top 10, he might be able to have an impact next summer by signing at least one player that could help. But he's probably going to lose Neto, and then they're back at square one, and he can enjoy trying to turn it around again.
Aberdeen have parted company with Neil Warnock. He has stepped aside after they won the Scottish Cup quarter-final. He was there for 34 days. I was honoured to lead Aberdeen for a short period to help Dave and the board. I presume Dave is the chairman of Aberdeen. Get themselves into a position where they could get closer to making a permanent appointment. It goes without saying that I had hoped I could have collected a few more league wins along the way. I'm also delighted to have helped the club into the Scottish Cup semi-final. I hope they can go on and lift the trophy. So they beat Kilmarnock 3-1 into the semi-finals. Callum says, do any of the panellists have something in their fridge that's been there longer than Valerian Ishmael's Watford tenure? He was there for 305 days, so I hope not. But yeah, there's probably a jar of something near the back, isn't there? Luke says, with Tom Cleverley announced as Watford's new interim head coach, how old do the panel feel?
I'm pretty sure I have a jar of cranberry sauce somewhere that has served longer than any manager in the 92
club. I thought you were going to say is older than Tom Cleverley then.
It was there before Herbert Chapman got the Arsenal job. If you would like to check your fridges to see if you have anything that's been there longer than Valerian Ishmael, please do. Footballweekly at theguardian.com. The stat of the day from the journalist Will Robinson says there have been more Watford managers since 2019 than there have been Dalai Lamas since 1589, which I think is a brilliant statistic, isn't it? Charlie says, you can't help but feel happy for Neil Harris at Millwall, can you? Another win for them as they look to cement their position in the Championship. Good luck to you, Neil. Where I'm now part of the Gary Monk revolution. A one-all draw at home to Northampton. Every point counts. And Paul says, whatever happened to Tapwater? Yeah, this was Neville Southall, who is brilliant on social media. And he sometimes gives his Twitter handle to someone else. So I don't know if someone was on it or this was Neville saying, whatever happened to Tapwater? People only drink water now if it comes from a lake on Venus, transported by vegan sharks and sold by a yoga-teaching octopus. You know.
He shops at Waitrose, I guess.
Yeah, that's true. Is that tap water?
I've been sipping tap water throughout this pod.
Yeah. I'm looking forward to the next Things Fell Apart episode where John Ronson is in Neville Southall's living room about tap water.
Yeah, asking Neville about David Moyes and where he stands on the whole situation. Anyway, love to Big Nev, the greatest goalkeeper of all time. Bar none. That'll do for today. Thanks, Will.
Thanks, Max.
Thanks, Alon. Good luck with the title challenge.
Oh, thank you.
Cheers, Baz.
Thank you.
Football Weekly is produced by Joel Grove. Our executive producer is Danielle Stevens. Champions League this week. We'll be back on Wednesday.
This is The Guardian.